This is Rabbi Josh Yoder of the Stanton Street Shul. Thank you for downloading this class podcast. These classes are provided free of charge through the generosity of the Stanton Street Shul community and supporters like you. If you do enjoy them, please consider making a donation to our synagogue's building fund on our website's shop donate page at www.stantonstshul.com.
Good morning, Sunday, March 9th, 2014. I'd like to thank people for coming today. We don't have as many as usual. I'm blaming the clock. This is daylight savings time, for which I do blame George W. Bush for making it this early. That is entirely his fault. So maybe next week, you know, people get a little more sleep, or, you know, back into their, well, you don't get more sleep, but get back into your cycle and, you know, it evens out later. But anyway, I really do appreciate people coming out, because a Sunday morning right after daylight savings time is not easy for anyone. So we're starting chapter 10 of Rambam's Hilchot Shabbat and Mishneh Torah, beginning with a subject of knots. And I am going to avoid all knot-related puns because we're all tired. Start us off, Dana.
A person who ties a knot which is intended to remain permanently and which can be tied only by a craftsman is liable. Included in this category are the knots tied by camel drivers, the knots tied by seamen, the knots tied by shoemakers when making shoes and sandals. One who ties a knot that's intended to remain permanently but does not require a craftsman to tie it is not liable. A knot that will not remain permanently and does not require a craftsman may be tied with no compunction.
Okay. So here, one of the prohibitions, I keep saying prohibitions, one of the categories of avot melacha, the main categories of forbidden labor, is tying a knot. So what is the shiur? What does it mean to tie a knot in such a way that it is prohibited on Shabbat? You need two criteria. One, kesher shel kiyama, a knot that is a permanent knot, and it has to be a ma'aseh uman, which is a skilled craft knot. If it is both of them, you violate Shabbat biblically. If you do one of the two, then it is rabbinic. But if it is a permanent knot that is also not a skilled knot, then it is 100% permitted. Now, you can imagine, when you get to the details, this gets somewhat complicated, because people actually argue over this. There was a book, some of you might be familiar with Professor Daniel Sperber. So one of the things that, you know, made his career, where he started becoming known early on in his career, was, I think this is his dissertation, but I could be wrong about that. He wrote something called Nautica Talmudica, where in order to help solve the Rishonim, the medieval debates over what counted as a skilled knot, he did historical research over what were the types of knots used on boats in the times of the rabbinic sages. So he actually went in and studied the history of knot making. Fascinating stuff. Well, if you're into this sort of thing, it's fascinating. But it's also one way of, you know, trying to solve these problems, which is, you know, you've got theoretical arguments, but rabbis rarely tie knots. I only know like two Eagle Scouts. One of them's my cousin. Neither one is a rabbi, right? So maybe if you have more Eagles, more Eagle Scouts out there, you know the difference. But we're not known for knot making. So in that respect, you go back to, well, what were the types of knots they were talking about? Yeah.
Well, supposing somebody was just showing off and decided to tie their shoes with a fancy knot.
Yeah.
It's not meant to be permanent.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just fancy.
Right, so we can go through, you know, the details here about, you know, what exactly does it mean. We'll go through, like, a little bit more of the details later on. But let's say, in that situation, it might be a ma'aseh uman, it might be a skilled knot, but it's not permanent.
Right.
Seems to me that would be rabbinic. Right, that would be rabbinically prohibited. Something else that's going
it's
to...
still prohibited.
Right, rabbinically, not biblically.
But regular tying shoes, obviously, is fine.
And you'll find people who would argue about that too, no doubt, but it would be my opinion that since when you tie a bow, one, it's not permanent. Two, probably doesn't come under that skilled category. And if you want to know the difference between how is a bow not a skilled category, again, go to Wikipedia and look at different types of knots. And some of them are really complicated and serve, like, very specific purposes.
Four-year-olds are trained to tie their shoes.
Doesn't mean it's not skilled. Four-year-olds do things that are kind of skilled.
Ah, but he says what? Professional? professional craftsman.
I don't know. Well, let's say you start your kids off at a young age. You've got like a guild or something. I don't listen. I'm not arguing with that. I happen to think you can tie your shoes with a normal bow on Shabbat, but some people, incidentally, might argue against a double knot. Because once you double knot, you ever do this? This is one of the, when I was, you know, growing up, one of the ways they said to keep your shoelaces tied is after you make the bow, you tie those two bows together into a knot. Okay. Now, some people had issues with that because even though that knot might not be a skilled knot, that could be enough to give it permanence. Because it wouldn't come undone on its own. A few other examples before we get to details here. One, glila.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So, glila, when you come to shul, or let's talk about Ashkenazi shuls, because Sfarnim read from a different form of Sefer Torah. Actually, we've got a miniature one of that here, so we can show you, for example. Ha! I have no idea where this came from. I just know it's on the shelf.
I always thought that was a Bessamen box.
What? You're kidding. You've never seen the Sfardi Sefer Torah? Okay. So, Sfardim, by Sfardim, let's just say Edot Mizrach. I know people in my shul yell at me when we confuse those. Their Sefer Torah look like this, which you may or may not have seen. Have you ever seen one of these, like full size? Really? You have? Cool. I actually, in Springfield, New Jersey, someone donated one of these. I find them really hard to lean from because you're like reading at it vertically. So they, you know, it's in this case, massive. You know, when you roll it, you know, just by pulling on these things, you don't really do galila. You don't like do any winding things up. So these, you know, are an exception.
Yanina has them.
All right. Ah, that would make sense. So in our shuls with Nosach Ashkenaz, where you've got the two poles on the side, you pick up, that's called hagba, where you lift it up. You roll it together, that's galila. Now, after you put it together, I mean, it's not like in this case here where it just stays put, you usually tie it with something, sometimes you actually do tie it, where you'll have like a cloth thing that you wrap around and you make a bow. You know, you can also have other like fasteners things, which you don't have the same problems with. Another issue that comes up is Simchas Torah. In certain synagogues, particularly those with children, one of the pranks that people pull on Simchas Torah is kids will run around and tie guys' talitot together. You ever see that? You never yeah. seen that? So, yeah. So that could be a problem. Not to say that the kids are doing a ma'aseh uman, not that they're doing skilled knots, but I can tell you that when they do like quintuple knots, that could easily be a kesher shel kayama. So while it might be prohibited for the kids to tie it, it would be equally prohibited for someone to untie it, as we're going to see later. Because anything that's forbidden to tie is forbidden to untie. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Mike? Number two.
How is the intermediate category defined? If one of a person's sandal straps tore and he tied it, a rope tore and one tied it, one tied a rope to a bucket, or one tied the bridle of an animal, the person is not liable. The same applies to all other knots that do not require professional expertise, but are always tied with intention that they remain permanently.
Mm-hmm.
Any knot that is not intended to remain permanently is forbidden to be tied using a knot that requires professional expertise.
Mm-hmm. All right. Same. Big sense so far? Mm-hmm. All right. Number three.
A woman may tie the opening of her cloak, although it has two openings. She may tie the strands of a hairnet, although it hangs loosely on her head. One may tie the straps of shoes and sandals that are tied around one's foot when donning them. One may tie pouches of wine and pouches of oil, although they have two protrusions. One may tie a pot of meat, although it is impossible to remove the meat without untying the knot. One may tie a bucket with a linen cord, a belt, or another similar entity, but not with an ordinary rope. One may tie a rope before an animal or tie it to an animal's foot so that it will not go out, although that involves two knots. If a rope is tied to a cow, one may tie it to its feeding trough. If a rope is tied to a feeding trough, one may tie it to a cow. One may not, however, bring a rope from one's home and tie it to both a cow and a feeding trough. If, however, one has a weaver's rope, which one is permitted to carry, one may bring it and tie it to both the cow and the feeding trough. The rationale for these laws is that all the above do not require professional expertise, nor are they intended to remain. On the contrary, a person ties them and unties them at will. Therefore, it is permitted to tie them with no compunctions. One may untie the openings of baskets of dates and dried figs, break off or cut off the cord, take them and eat them.
Right, so these were examples that might have been more relevant to his day. To our day, the shoelaces is probably the most relevant. I would argue, you know, as Dana would put it, it's not a skilled knot to do one of those things, and you're not intending for it to be a permanent knot. You expect it to come undone with relative ease, and the whole point is when you make that bow, you just pull one thread of it and bam, right, it falls apart. So that makes a little bit, I think, makes things a little more relevant. Another somewhat related halacha, though slightly off direct topic with the tying, is that any substance that is fit to be used as animal fodder may be used for tying on Shabbat. Therefore, if the straps of a person's sandal snapped in a carmelite, you can take a moist reed that is fit to be eaten by an animal and wind it around the sandal and tie it, assuming, of course, you're not using a permanent knot for it. A sandal strap slips from its place, or one's foot slips from the sandal, one may return the strap to its place, provided one does not tie a knot. All right, Dana? Five.
It is permitted to tie a loop on the Sabbath, for it will not be interchanged with a knot. Therefore, if a rope snapped, one may gather the two ends together, wind a linen cord around them, and tie a loop.
Yeah, there's even some debate over here about, like, the difference about knots and stuff, but we'll, again, hold that aside at least. Mike?
It is permissible to tie a knot that is not permanent in nature for the purpose of a mitzvah. For example, one may tie a knot to calibrate one of the Torah's measures. One may tie a harp string that snaps in the temple, but not anywhere else. One may not tie a harp string for the first time on the Sabbath, even in the temple.
Sorry about that. Okay. Right, so for permanent mitzvah, on that thing with the mitzvah, seen footnote 22, its commentary to the Mishnah, Rambam states that the leniency is granted regarding to tying knots that are intended to remain permanently if they are tied for the sake of a Mishnah on Shabbat. Rashi maintains that the Mishnah grants leniency with regard to measuring alone and not to tying knots that are not temporary in nature. So on this basis, this halacha must be interpreted to mean that one is allowed to tie knots that will not remain permanently, even with a knot that requires professional expertise, or a knot that is intended to remain for an extended period if it does not require professional expertise. I'm not so sure if that's the way the halacha must be interpreted, because Rambam doesn't have to follow Rashi, but at any rate, these are different variations on the theme. Keep in mind, it's permanence and skilled. Yeah.
He mentions the harp string in the temple because one is allowed to do these things specifically for temple service, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the only reason it's allowed.
Well, you might also recall that there was stuff that went in the temple service that are otherwise prohibited on Shabbat.
Yeah.
Like sacrifices.
Right.
So, yeah.
But that's what he's referring to.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Sure? Seven?
Seven. A person is liable for untying any knot that he is liable for tying. Whenever a person is not liable for tying a knot, he is not liable for untying it. Whenever a person is permitted to tie a knot, he is permitted to untie it.
So one of the, this is one of those double categories thing where you're obligated for the action and you're obligated for the reverse action. So for any knot that it was forbidden for you to tie, you would be forbidden to untie it on the exact same level of severity. If the knot was a biblical prohibition for you to have tied, it's a biblical prohibition for you to untie. Same thing for rabbinic. If it was a rabbinic prohibition for you to tie, prohibition for you to untie. Same thing with permitted stuff. You can also, let's throw in another example here. What about tying a tie on Shabbos? I'm assuming for those of us who wear ties, we've graduated past clip-ons.
I would say it doesn't require professional expertise and it's not permanent.
Right. So for one, it's most assuredly not permanent because no one does. I mean, no one that I know just like keeps their ties tied up. As far as Ma'aseh Uman, It's an interesting question there, because, I mean, the truth is, I happen to agree with you. I don't think it's a professional knot.
It depends on the knot, I guess.
Right. So there are some funky ways to tie a tie, and you can go online and see there's some really crazy tie. I mean, most people tie, like, either a full Windsor or a half Windsor. Those are, like, normal business ties. The craziest one I saw is someone gave you instructions to tie your tie like Morpheus in The Matrix. Where it's got, like, some double things on the side.
Yeah, I know a guy who can do, like, six, like, pleats. It looks ridiculous.
Well, that's besides the point. So at what point do those ties become skilled? Or what about a bow tie? One of our former member of the shul, who, for all I know, might even be listening to this podcast right now, part of his Shabbat dress was he would wear a bow tie. Now, has anyone here actually tried tying a bow tie?
Yeah.
Would you consider that skilled?
I mean, you have to know how to do it, so...
Well, yeah, I guess it's like that for anything.
A lot of, I mean, it's not only professional people who wear bow ties.
Yeah, that's fair.
I would consider it bad form. I hate bow ties.
Well, there are few people who can pull it off.
Yeah.
I am not one of them, mind you. Some people can. But there are people who actually do.
That was a half pun, wasn't it?
What?
Pull off the tie?
No. Like I said, I'm avoiding them. Like, it'll be unintentional. If it is intentional, well, whatever.
You have to be like a rock star or an accountant to pull off a bow tie.
This guy's actually a business lawyer. He's got a JD MBA. So it's a little of both. But he also does it on Shabbos, which is something else entirely about, and it's somewhat unrelated to knots. We'll probably get to it later in the Rambam about one way that people treat Shabbat differently is they dress differently on Shabbat in one way or another. So people, you know, one reason why people wear suits on Shabbat, even in Israel, where people are incredibly casual, almost no one wears suits on Shabbat unless you're an American and, like, you're just there temporarily or you just made Aliyah, you happen to have suits, you know, you might just wear a white shirt and dark pants, right? But that's Big Day Shabbat. You're wearing something different for Shabbat. So for some people, wearing a bow tie is, you know, Big Day Shabbat. Somewhat of a thing there. So I would also contend that's probably not Masoman, but I have known people who intentionally don't untie their tie fully on Shabbat. What they do is they just make it the, you know, neck, I don't want to say neck hole, that just sounds ridiculous. But whatever, today I can blame everything on lack of sleep, but they just leave that loop open, set it down, and then the next morning they just put it on and tie it up. Whatever. Point is, if you think it's prohibited to tie, it is prohibited to untie.
Could you cut it?
Like a Gordanian knot thing?
No, just like with the knife.
I don't believe for other purposes, but no. But you know the whole Gordanian knot story. Seriously? Oh, it was that whole, like, Alexander, like, thing, went to a place, like, sign of leadership was there was this, like, completely untiable knot.
Oh.
And the way that he solved it was chop the rope.
Yeah.
Okay, so you've heard the story, you just didn't know that's what it was called.
Yeah.
Fair enough. All right, let it slide. A person who winds together rope from palm branches, is that love grass?
That's what it says.
Love grass, weird. What's the footnote here? Our translation is based on Rav Kapach's version. That's completely unhelpful. Strands of wool, strands of flax, strands of goat hair, or the... I'm going to guess that's like. Yes?
Or the like, is
liable for performing a derivative of the forbidden labor of tying. The minimum measure for which one is liable is a length of rope sufficient to remain wound without being tied, for then the work of the person is performed is permanent. Similarly, a person who unwinds cord performs a derivative of the forbidden labor of untying and is liable, provided one's intent is not merely destructive in nature. The minimum measure for which one is liable is the same as that for winding a cord. All right, because, you know, cords are the... you know what? This actually just reminds me of something. I should have mentioned this last week. I apologize. Because I was just, like, trying to visualize ideas of, like, when would you possibly, like, unwind stuff? It occurred to me, you can wind up doing stuff without thinking. Like, right behind Dana, we have a tallit. So those tzitzit, you bring over the tallit, Dana, just right behind you. So on the tzitzit, you'll notice that the fringes are made of, like, a wound type of fabric. You might be able to see it, which you can even unwind slightly here. You know, if you just want to play around with it. And there are ways which you can just, you know, worry about, like, hey, are you in fact untying stuff by just doing the unwinding thing? So this seems to be, I mean, you let go, it's going to come back. You haven't really fully unwound it. But that there, you know, could very well be a problem. What I should have mentioned last week, which didn't occur to me, is examples of, you know, last week we spoke about weaving and unweaving. So some examples which, you know, could come up is if you find a thread, like, loose on clothing, right? Pulling that out, it could be problematic. Certain things like a tie, you know, you find one loose thread, like the whole thing, like, goes, you know, with a silk thing. Also, in our books, in our Chumashim, also, the art scroll, art scroll for their bookmarks, for their Chumashim and for their Gemaras, have like a multiple woven bookmark. And they seal it off at the end with like some plastic thing here so it doesn't unravel. But inevitably it does unravel for at least many of the things we have here. In fact, I can even show you one. Right, this one. You see, it's already even popping out. Right? You see how that's unraveling towards the end? So it's very tempting to try to, you know, pull it off or perhaps tear it to prevent it. You won't be able to do that on Shabbat because the more that you pull it, it keeps on unraveling the stuff. So, yeah, I apologize for not bringing that up last week, but when the examples, I want to, you know, try to come up with examples where relevant, and sometimes they come and sometimes they don't. But anyway, it's something to keep in mind because these are things that you can do that you might even not be aware of. You know, it's things that you're just not really thoughtful of. I don't think this, you know, might apply to, say, Twizzlers, for example, because that's food. You know, one. You all know what Twizzlers are.
Yeah.
Okay.
You don't really unwind.
You could if you like play around. You want to like pull one strip off at a time.
They're not really wound. They're just made that way.
Well, they're kind of wound, but I wouldn't say that they were tied. And also,
little,
it's well,
tech. Elf that's winding the Twizzlers.
Well, not an elf, just a machine thing that, you know. And also, it's well, nominally food. Anyway, Dana.
A person who sews two stitches is liable, provided he ties the stitches at both ends so that they will remain and not slip out. If, however, one sews an additional stitch, one is liable even if one did not tie the ends, for one stitching will remain.
See, I'm completely losing my mind. I should have given that example after this. The truth is, you know, the reason why I got confused with that is because sometimes I honestly get confused with the difference between weaving and sewing, right? Because both of them, when you think about it mechanically, what you're doing are variations of a theme where you're taking one thread and you are I don't want to say weaving it, but you're interlocking it with another thread. That's what doing stuff on a loom is. That's what tying is. And that's also what sewing is. You might have a different technique for doing the stuff together, but essentially you're taking one, like, string or one, you know, malleable, cloth thing or whatever, and you're inter-something it with another one. Alright? So all of those things, I mean, we'll use, I mean, Dana, this goes back to your question from last week. You're going to use different words, right? But ultimately you're doing the same thing.
Sewing and stitching, you mean?
Sewing, stitching, using the loom and tying, functionally all do the same thing, where you're interweaving one piece of thread with another piece of thread in order to create a more permanent established structure.
And actually, tying could very well be one piece of thread within itself.
But that's still two. Yes, you're still talking about two ends.
Ends of one.
Right, but it's still functionally the same thing, even though you can do it with one string.
Yeah.
Okay. So continue. I'm sorry.
A person who pulls a taut thread used for sewing on the Sabbath is liable, because this activity is necessary for sewing.
Right, so this is...
Oh, who pulls taut.
Meaning, if you pull a taut, meaning even if you didn't actually... The only thing that you did was you pulled it, and that made everything tighter, that's bad. All right? So this also gets to pulling threads. I'm trying to think of an example where this comes up, where you might, like, pull it just to make it, the weaving thing, tighter, practically.
Like, if your button is coming off, you could just pull the thread to make sure it doesn't fall.
Usually when I pull thread on buttons, it just unravels more.
I don't
but,
have an example.
All right. Well, don't do it.
Yeah.
Well,
Mike? Halacha 10.
A person who tears the length of a garment sufficient to tie two stitches for sake of tying two stitches is liable. In contrast, one who tears with the intent to ruin is not liable, for his activity is destructive in nature.
So this answers your question about cutting the tie, right?
Because so it would be all right, right?
Well, when it says patur here, it says not liable, remember, that means it's rabbinically prohibited. It's when it uses what he calls the English term without compunction or permitted is when it's permitted.
So
right?
It's not biblically
prohibited, it's rabbinically prohibited because it's a destructive act. Okay. Now, if you took like that knife to the Gordanian knot because you wanted to tie a better one, that would be a problem biblically on Shabbat, because even though what you're doing is a destructive act, it's still ultimately for something creative. Yeah.
A person who tears in a fit of rage, and one who rends his garments for the sake of a deceased person for whom he is required to rend his garments, is liable. For by doing so, he settles his mind and calms his natural inclination. Since his anger is soothed through this act, it is considered to be constructive in nature, and he is liable.
Right, so this goes back to your question way back when about beating up a guy on Shabbat, how it makes you feel good. So here's another example of, like, since it's even though it's a technically destructive act, since you personally get some benefit from psychologically, that works. You know, it makes it biblical.
Person who makes an opening for a neck in a garment on the Sabbath is liable.
All right. Now, in terms of making the neck, it's the footnote here says the Merkavet HaMishnah states that this refers to simply opening up a place for the head in the garment, since the Rambam maintains that a person who performs Malacha She'ena Tzricha LaGufa is liable. He maintains that a person is liable for cutting an opening even though he doesn't sew it. I mean, I don't think anyone's been able to put on a piece of clothing without room for a head. So, kind of essential there.
Like if you had a tarp and you wanted to make it into a poncho.
Yes. Bingo. And you actually find that in New York today, too, the garbage bag poncho.
Yeah.
Sure. Shira, Halacha 11.
A person who attaches paper or hides together with scribe's glue and the like is liable for performing a derivative of the forbidden labor of sewing. Conversely, a person who separates papers or hides that are stuck together is liable for performing a derivative of the forbidden labor of tearing if his intent is not merely destructive.
Okay, now here's a case where this tearing thing does come up a lot in Jewish households, right? Because even, like, you're talking here about, you know, first he mentions here about separating things that are stuck together for a creative act, right? This is a derivative of korea, of tearing, which is, again, the opposite of, you know, well, what he calls here, you know, gluing. To explain, when people get svarim, sometimes they're adorned with a certain type of, what's a good word? Like this gold, I don't want to say lamé thing, what's the official thing for it? You'll find some Hebrew books that have, like, gold stuff on top. Now, when you open it up for the first time, either that or for some... Does that have what? No, I don't think that has gold stuff on top. Even not that. When you get Hebrew books, when they are printed, it is not uncommon to find pages that are stuck together. I found pages stuck together either A, because when they cut the pages, they were not cut, meaning it was still 100% sealed, like, together. I've also found books where when you've got the golden thing, when you pull it open, you hear it like... You know what I'm talking about. I can't mimic the sound, but it's almost like bristling apart. That, according to Rambam, would be a problem. Because if these things were attached, by you opening it, they're becoming unattached. So what people sometimes do is flip through these, you know, a new book before Shabbat to at least try to undo all of that. But there, you know, could very well be a problem. That's why people are, you know, might be a little bit strict with that. In the footnote here, he writes, Simagin Avram, which states that the entities one separates must have been attached to each other with the intent of remaining permanently. And based on a similar rationale, Chacham Tzvi does not hold one liable for opening an envelope, since the flap is not intended to remain permanently closed. And he says, there is a common application of this principle today, the use of disposable baby diapers. Since the flap is not intended to remain permanently closed, fastening or unfastening it is not intended to, is not related to the forbidden labors of sewing and tearing, which I'm sure parents might be happy to know. Using this logic, you would have absolutely no problem with the book issue, not when they're actually physically connected and the cutter just missed the page, but the gold stuff that might kind of serve as a glue is not a problem. So it gets kind of amusing in that respect, because if you're going to be super strict for the Rambam regarding the books, you would also have to be super strict regarding baby diapers, which I don't think people want to do. Yeah.
Okay. So what about something like the like two pieces of a cloth in a Sefer Torah that are coming undone, and it's your only Sefer Torah?
Well, you wouldn't be able to tie it on Shabbat. Like, you wouldn't
be able
to.
No, but the separates papers or hides that are stuck together.
So no one does that on, you know, intentionally.
No.
Right.
Well, I mean, I'm talking about putting them back together. It's like they're coming apart.
Yeah, you wouldn't be able to fix it on Shabbat. You fix it after Shabbat. Let's throw in another question here for you. What do y'all think about Velcro?
That should be fun. It's not.
Oh,
really.
That's totally not meant to be permanent.
Okay.
And it's also, it takes no skill whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, Rambam doesn't seem to make those, you know, distinctions here in terms of the permanence. That seems to be the Magen Avraham, right? But according to Rambam, I mean, listen, you can, I would also think, you know, Velcro isn't meant to be permanent. So the reason why you have Velcro is that you just want it to stay in place temporarily before you get rid of it.
Is this why some people tear toilet paper?
Yeah, I think that, you know, we'll go into a little bit more detail about that later. Okay. In terms of, you know, some more details about the tearing thing in terms of like measurements and whatnot and doing it on a measured roll. But yes, if you go to Israel, you find it more common in Israel than you do in America.
Yeah.
Of people who will pre-tear toilet paper, will get like packets of it where it's already pre-torn to avoid the problem of tearing.
Mm.
I believe Rambam should get to that in some later halacha. If not, someone hopefully will yell at me to get back to stuff. Anyway, now we're up to building. A person is liable for building even the slightest amount. Right? So remember when we're talking about shirim, a little bit of building counts. What are we talking about here? A person who levels the floor inside a house is liable. Whether he lowers a raised piece of earth or fills a cavity, he is considered building and is liable. When one places down a stone and another the mortar, the one who places down the mortar is liable. For the highest row of stones, one is liable merely for lifting the stone and placing it on the mortar, since the other mortar is not placed upon it. A person who builds a base on utensils is not liable. And the footnote here, as the source for this halacha, Magid Mishnah points to the following passage from the Jerusalem Talmud. Where is the forbidden labor of building found in the sanctuary? In the placement of boards in their sockets. Is this meant to imply that building on a base of utensils is considered building? The sockets are considered as the ground. Yeah, you're puzzled. It gets into a little more detail here.
No, I'm just wondering, can you build in Israel? Because remember, you could sign a deed for a house in Israel?
Yeah, the answer is no.
Okay.
The deed for the house seems to be, yeah, because that was, I would say probably not. That, let's leave it at that.
This implies permanence, right?
Details. 13. Like, again, this is the way Rambam usually works. Gives you a general law.
Yes.
Subsequent laws, it gives you examples in detail. So let's do those. 13.
A person who erects a permanent tent is liable for performing a derivative of the forbidden labor of building. Similarly, a person who fashions a brazenware utensil, usually an oven or a jug, before they are fired in a kiln, is liable for performing a derivative of the forbidden labor of building. Similarly, one who makes cheese performs a derivative of the forbidden labor of building. One is not liable until one makes an amount of cheese equivalent to the size of a dried fig. A person who inserts the blade of an axe onto its handle, or one who performs any similar activity, performs a derivative of the forbidden labor of building. Similarly, one who attaches one piece of wood to another, whether he attaches them with a nail or by inserting one piece of wood into another until they become a single entity, is liable for performing a derivative of the forbidden labor of building.
So there are a bunch of things here, some of which... Now, the first one is the ohel, is the tent. Now here, Maimonides says a permanent tent, which seems to indicate it doesn't matter the permanence of your structure. Because let's face it, not all structures are permanent. Mm-hmm. But a tent... you know, kind of is permanent. That comes up a whole lot today regarding umbrellas, right? An umbrella's opening and closing an umbrella would be problematic based on this regard. There are other details in terms of awnings, and that was one of the examples, if you remember when I quoted from the Gray Ribiat book, where he tries to make a distinction where if you've got an awning that's already attached to a building, to open and close it, it's fine, but he says, even though that same logic should apply to umbrellas, well, great rabbis already said that umbrellas are no good, so don't ask any more questions, which I found... You know, for a thousand, you know, for a four-volume book spanning thousands of pages is a really insufficient answer. I can buy it in a one-volume book, but like when the whole point is to explain and you know you caught yourself in bad logic, you know, to just, anyway, that's my own private rant on that guy.
But the Royal Society for putting things on top of other things could meet on Shabbos.
2 points for the Monty Python reference. Anyway, yeah, another important thing here is this cheese thing, right? Now, many people here don't make cheese, let alone on Shabbat. A few places where this sort of thing does come up, where people will apply it to, is one, making ice.
Oh, boy.
People will not make ice on Shabbat because it's a derivative of building. Two, in terms of changing form. Here's another place where you'll find this. If you go to Israel... you can find a toothpaste called Taydent, T-A-Y-D-E-N-T. It comes in a little triangle case, and this is kosher for Shabbat toothpaste. The concern being, just as turning cheese, right, which is something like you've got some liquid and making cheese on Shabbat turns it solid, the inverse would be prohibited because of destroying. So if you would take solid-ish toothpaste, you start brushing your teeth with it, you're changing the form from a solid to a liquid, and that would be prohibited on Shabbat on these grounds, which is why you find people who have kosher for Shabbat toothpaste.
So which is liquid? Just liquid?
Kinda, yeah. I actually got it for someone as a wedding gift, sort of accidentally, because a friend of mine got married, and I asked, well, hey, need anything from Israel? And he said, oh, toothpaste. I said, okay, fine, this will be your wedding gift. So I can now say I got her toothpaste for her wedding gift. But she did ask for it. But if you go to Israel and you see what is this Taydent and kosher for Shabbat toothpaste, this is kind of off of, you know, what it's based. Because of this issue of that this act of making cheese, having stuff that, you know, and to what extent do you continue that too with doing anything that might congeal in terms of being bona, right? For all intents and purposes, you know, to apply this to, say, Jell-O. Now, I know Jell-O, you normally need hot stuff. I mean, but let's say you can make cold Jell-O.
Yeah.
You can make cold Jell-O with, like, Jell-O with cold water.
And you, well, if it's refrigerated...
You can make Jell-O with cold fusion?
I would assume so.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
If it's refrigerated.
Right, so you might even use the same logic to apply to Jell-O.
Well, but hang on. If with, and again, maybe not to get too carried away with ice, but if you're putting something on top of a surface that happens to be cold or isn't sort of the... It's sort of the reverse of Bishul.
I don't know what you mean.
We talked about how if a surface isn't necessarily hot to begin with, or if a surface happens to be hot and you put something on it.
Ah.
So is the reverse true with freezing something?
No.
Why?
Well, because there's no prohibition of, like, there's a prohibition of Bishul, of cooking.
Yeah.
But they didn't have freezing back in the day. Right? Interesting other question you can have with this, too. Melting ice. Yeah. Right? Because if it's going to be a problem with bonus, we're going to see, like, you know, melting ice would be as much of a problem. Or ice cream. right? You wouldn't be allowed to have ice cream sit for too long because it's going to melt.
But it's going to melt. You're not doing anything to make it melt.
Well, you're taking it out of the freezer.
You're not allowed to let nature take its course.
I am throwing out ideas here. I am not issuing any sort of sock. Who are we up to? Think Mike? 14.
A person who makes the slightest hole in a chicken coop to let light in is liable for building. A person who returns a door of a well, a cistern, or a wing of a building to its place is liable for building.
Mm-hmm. All right, Chair, 15.
A person who demolishes even the slightest amount is liable, provided he demolishes with the intent to build. If his intent by demolishing is merely destructive, he is not liable. A person who demolishes a permanent tent or separates a piece of wood attached to another is liable for performing a derivative of the forbidden labor of demolishing, provided his intent is to improve.
Right, so anyone who does construction work, you know, if you make a mistake, you know, sometimes you have to undo stuff to do stuff later. Or when Rambam writes, you know, when you, building can be like putting stuff on top of things, it could also mean clearing a place, like on the foundation, which is what he said at the very beginning, if you just flatten out a surface, even though you say, oh, that's a destructive act, well, no. Even though you're leveling it off, leveling can be a constructive act. So destruction is only a problem if it's, or let me rephrase that, destruction is only a biblical problem if your intent is to create. Again, we'll leave it as an open question. If you are just a psychotic and you like destroying things, maybe you derive some benefit from destroying stuff. That's a separate issue. Like if you're the 5-year-old and you want to, you know, play Godzilla on your little toy town.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, what about kids' toys?
That is a wonderful question. So when it comes to kids' toys, so the kids themselves don't have an obligation of Shabbat, right? Because they don't have a mitzvah. There's a separate rule regarding chinuch. Parents are obligated to teach their children Torah and to teach them to follow halacha. You do not necessarily have to intervene if they are doing something wrong, but there does seem to be a problem with training children to do things that are incorrect. Right. So an example, I remember learning, this was, I think, when we did Sukkah with Rabbi Tendler, because there it discusses Katan Yodel in Na'anea, that the first time you give a kid a lulav and etrog to shake on Sukkot is when they actually know how to shake. Right, so you don't give it to a 1-year-old, but you might give it to a 4-year-old, depending on the development. And we spent some time in there, and I'm recalling learning in a Rashi that you don't even teach kids to recite Kriyat Shema before they go to sleep if they can't stay up late. Because, you know, let's say a kid's bedtime is, I don't know, 6 o'clock, let's say 7. I don't know what time kids get put to sleep. When your kid goes to sleep at 7 o'clock in the winter, they would be saying Kriyat Shema correctly. In the summer, they wouldn't. So even that you don't do. So what do you do with things like Legos? You know, there's one of encouraging kids to do Legos, and two is, what do you do yourself with that? So on one hand, you could say, like, Dana, it's clearly not really permanent. Right? Or is it? Some Legos could be permanent. You have the exhibit. I think it's still going on in Midtown. The Lego exhibit. Guy made like a bunch of really cool Lego sculptures. You see the ad? There's like this giant Lego thing of a guy ripping out his chest and like Legos are coming out.
Yeah,
y'all need to get out more. And when I'm telling you to get out more, you do. Look on, you know what? You don't even need that. Go to Google, search for like Lego statues. Yeah. It could very well be possible. Does that necessarily count here? I'm going to leave that as an open question. I will even let people, you know, debate between Legos and Lincoln Logs, right? Because Legos, you can say, might have a little more permanence to that too, right, than Lincoln Logs. And don't forget, putting it up would be the same thing as taking it down. And you got a whole bunch of other building tools. Something new is magnetiles. I just saw those recently. You ever see magnetiles? He needs to tell you a lot more about stuff. They're basically like little rectangles and triangles that are held together with magnets.
For building?
Yeah, you build little structures. I'm about to say magnets. How do they work? But no. All right, you all need to listen to more Insane Clown Posse. All right.
No one needs to do that.
You must have seen the video Miracles.
I have not. No.
Okay, that is an assignment. Go home. You just need to watch it just for how ridiculous it is. And it's become an internet meme. Especially if there's a lyric in there, effing magnets, how do they work? Oh. Just watch it for it. It is, yeah, watch it.
The podcast needs to come with footnotes and links.
It really does. That should be most of my conversations. Like, oh, Subba, listen to this. Anyway, I will leave those as open questions in terms of how do you do with kids' toys about building and also taking them apart. Yeah.
Sure.
The name of the malacha is Ma'akebapati.
That's the next one. That's 16. We haven't gotten there yet.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Right? So this is just the building part, but since you brought it up, thank you for giving us a segue that gets us back on topic for a change. Halacha 16, a person who gives the final blow with a hammer is liable. Similarly, a person who performs any activity that represents the completion of a task is liable for performing a derivative of dealing the final hammer blow. What is implied? A person who blows a glass vessel, one who makes a design or even a portion of a design on a utensil, one who planes the renders the term used as to scrape the edges of a utensil. One who makes a hole or even the smallest size of a piece of wood, a building, a piece of metal, utensil is liable for performing a derivative of dealing the final hammer blow. One is not liable for making a hole unless it can be used to bring something
in and bring out.
So this is a place where I think it's easy to get confused between building and the final hammer blow of what you call makeba patish, right? Because in the previous law, he wrote about who does the building. So if I just put a brick down, that's not building. It's only building if someone comes and puts mortar on, because a brick is a brick. You haven't really done anything. The way we build with brick is brick, mortar, brick, mortar. In terms of the top one, it's whoever did the last, like on the bottom one, it's whoever does the mortar. But in terms of ending it, whoever puts the, whatchamacallit, the last brick on top, he's liable even if no more mortar comes up, because that's still part of the building process. So what's this makeba patish thing then? Because that last brick isn't considered the final hammer blow, that's considered you've actually built something. The final hammer blow, as I understand it, is the last action, meaning let's say there's a multi-step process in the action, right? And that last thing is the one that actually does it in. That's the problem. Where this gets applied, I think, most often today is regarding electricity, right? One of the reasons why people want to forbid it is when you flip the switch for a circuit, you've done that final act of completing this connections of wires. That is an argument that is given by electricity. Although as my former boss at Information asked a wonderful question, but if that's really prohibited, how could you ever close a door?
Wow.
Because that's one of the reasons why I love talking this stuff with non-Jews, because he does simple. He also asked me a great question with asking the non-Jew to push buttons for the elevator, where he asked me, isn't that cheating? I was like, well, he lives in Riverdale, so he sees this a bunch. Great, great guy. But that's a wonderful question. I never thought of that. Closing the door, you could say it's makeba patish, because you're finishing off the wall. But again, we're not going to, the goal of this point isn't to paskin what's okay and what isn't okay, as much as to try to explain the difference between what is considered building and what is considered the final hammer. And the final hammer thing can apply to lots of different stuff, right? Because you can say that last hammer act might not in its own right be enough of a shiur. Remember, that was something that we've talked about a lot. Everything you need has to, gather thoughts. Every prohibition that we have has a minimal shiur, has a minimal amount of stuff that you need to do. Makeba patish, that final act, might be less than the technical shiur, but if that act was that final act of completion, then that would be the problem. Right? And it's a little, I understand that it could be difficult of like, well, how is it different than something else? A way of viewing it is, even if that act alone in its own right might be trivial, if that was the final thing that did it, you are prohibited because of that. Okay? Continue. Dana, 7.
A person who pierces a blister on the Sabbath to widen the opening of the wound, as physicians do with the intent of widening the opening of the wound, is liable for performing a derivative of dealing the final hammer blow, for this is a labor performed by a physician. If one pierced it to remove its pus, the act is permitted.
Right. So again, if you're trying to like increase what was already done, right? Like you didn't actually make it, right? But you want to make it bigger for some reason. If you're just trying to, you know, alleviate the pressure, Rambam says that that's fine. Mm. Right? But here's another good example. Something was already made, right? You're just now making it bigger. Right? That's a problem for Makeba Patish. Right? Cuz you're doing the final act in this process. Mike, number 18.
One who files a stone to even the slightest degree is liable for performing a derivative of dealing the final hammer blow. A person who aligns a stone in the foundation of a building, adjusting its position with his hands and settling it in its proper place, is liable for performing a derivative of dealing the final hammer blow. A person who removes threads, straws, or splinters of wood from a garment by hand, for example, the splinters that are found in woolen garments, is liable for performing a derivative of dealing the final hammer blow. This applies provided the person is
disturbed by them.
If, however, he removes them as a matter of course, without thinking, he is not liable. A person who shakes out a new black garment to make it attractive and to remove any remnants of white wool adhering to it, as a tailor's practice, is liable to bring a sin offering. If he is not disturbed by them, it is permissible to do so.
So here are a whole bunch of other examples of Makeba Patish that illustrate that even if it might not be, you know, a vishi or something that's prohibited, you still violate Jewish law. So one example here, fixing a building, right? Let's say you see a stone out of place and you just want to push it in a little, right? So you haven't actually built anything, but your act completes the wall. You've improved it. You know, if you've got woolen stuff, sometimes you find pitting, right? So pulling that stuff out, you are completing the action, even if you haven't technically untied anything. Because remember, when you pull out threads, you can say, well, you're undoing the weaving process. But let's say, even if you're just shaking out, like you've got something new, right? And you're, you know, you want to clean it off a little because you've got some tailor stuff. Well, you can say, well, wait a second. That's stuff that the manufacturer should have done. So you're now, since you're doing stuff that the manufacturer should have done, that's considered Makeba Patish.
What if it's cat hair and you have a cat?
So that, but then it's not new. So. Meaning, then, you know, that's something else entirely. It's, that's why he said here, particularly the new one, it's Talit Chadasha, right? So that the action that you did, like when you buy new stuff that's manufactured, many things that are manufactured, sometimes you've got, depending on the quality of workmanship, you might find some stuff that's left over, right? So even if you don't actually build it, but you just make certain tweaks that the manufacturer would have done, even if those tweaks themselves might not be prohibited, like shaking out clothing on Shabbat itself isn't a problem, but if it's something that the manufacturer should have done, then it is because you completed that act. And he does mention, though, that it, like that's where he put it, kiderach she'umanim osin. If you do it in the way that the uman, that the craftsman made it, that would be a problem. All right. So it could apply to, you know, almost anything there, and you know, it could be a sign of, you know, get stuff with good quality control or take care of it before Shabbos. But if you're disturbed by them, if you're not disturbed by them, it is mutar. So the difference here is like shomanimo sichayev if it. So if it's kedarsha uma, 1 second. If you do it exactly the way that they, you know, they did it, then you're chayav chatat. But then he says here, v'im eino makpid mutar. But if you're not doing it, you know, consciously, that would be fine, as opposed to the other things, which are, you know, you remove them as a matter of course without thinking, then you're still obligated for it. All right, moving on. What are we up to?
19.
All right. A person, now we're up to trapping. A person who traps a living creature from a species that is common to trap, like beasts, fowl, or fish, is liable, provided he traps them in a place where no further efforts are required to trap them. So what does this mean? One chased a deer until one caused it to enter a room, a garden, a courtyard, and one locked it inside, or caused a fowl to fly in a closet and locked it. One removed a fish from a sea and placed it in a bowl of water. In all these instances, a person is liable. If, however, a person caused a bird to fly in a room and locked it, caused a fish to swim from a sea into a pool of water, or chased a deer until he caused it to enter a large hall and locked it, he is not liable. The living creature is not completely trapped, for if he too desired to take... If he too desired to take it, he would have to chase it and trap it in this new place. Therefore, a person who traps a lion is not liable until he causes it to enter the pen in which it will be enclosed. So here would be an example. Let's say, there's a fly in your house. You close the door in a room, you haven't trapped the fly. You would trap the fly if you would, say, catch it in a cup. Right, that would be a trap. Or we speak about the bee traps. Right, it's why you can't set those up before Shabbat. Right, or let's say a cat. Right, cats walk around, your apartment all the time. You would not be able to put a cat in a one of those carrier thingies. Right, but closing the door behind you and a cat, not considered trapping. Dana.
The following, a place in which if a person ran, he could reach the animal in a single movement, and a place so narrow that the shadow of both walls would merge in the middle, are considered to be small places. If one chased a deer or the like into such a place, one is liable. If a place is larger than this, a person who chases an animal or a fowl into it is not liable.
Mm-hmm. Mike, 21.
The following principle applies regarding the 8 creeping animals mentioned in the Torah, and similarly other creeping animals and crawling things. When a species is usually trapped, a person who traps any one of them, whether for a purpose or without a purpose, even merely for the sake of sport, is liable since he intended to trap and actually did so. A person is liable for performing forbidden labor, even if he has no need for the actual labor he performed. A person who traps an animal that is sleeping or a blind animal is liable.
Yeah, so don't trap a blind animal. It doesn't matter. So let's say you've got a sleeping animal, right? So did you really trap it? Well, because you didn't do anything for it. The animal doesn't know either way. It's not a matter of what the animal thinks the animal is trapped. The animal is, did you actually do something? Right?
A lot of animals can't even think.
Well, yes, but an animal, will know if it's caged sometimes. But so by mentioning this halakha, Rambam is teaching that we're not talking about animal psychology. It's not that the animal knows it's been trapped. That's irrelevant. What matters is, did you do the trapping? Continue with 22.
When a person sends out dogs to trap deer, rabbits, and the like, the deer flees because of the dog, and the person chases after the deer or stands before it and as such frightens it so that the dog can catch it, he is liable for performing a derivative of the forbidden labor of trapping. The same applies with regard to trapping fowl.
Yeah, so no dog stuff. Remember reading, there was a historian, Cecil Roth, who wrote stuff about... never mind. Way, way too off topic. When a deer enters a room and one person closes it, the latter is liable. If two people close it, they are not liable. If the door cannot be closed by a single person and they both close it, they are both liable. Right? You might remember this from the very beginning when we spoke about carrying. When one person sat at the entrance and did not block it, and the second person sat down and blocked it, the second person is liable. When one person blocks the entrance when he sits down, and the second when he sits next to him, that also just the first person alone is liable. Okay, we can skip the rest of this. You get the idea. Dana, 24.
A person who traps a deer that is old, limping, sick, or small is not liable. A person who releases an animal, a beast, or a fowl from a trap is not liable. A person who traps a beast or a fowl that is in his domain, ducks, chickens, or doves from a coat, is not liable.
Mm-hmm.
A person who traps a living being whose species is not usually trapped, like locusts, wild bees, hornets, mosquitoes, fleas, and the like, is not liable.
Mm-hmm. All right, and wrap us off here, because this actually gets us back to that bee question earlier.
Crawling beasts that are dangerous, e.g. snakes, scorpions, and the like, may be trapped on the Sabbath. This leniency is granted even when they are not deadly, but merely bite, provided one's intent is to prevent someone from being bitten. What should one do? Place a utensil over them, cover them with something, or tie them so they cannot cause damage?
Right. So the question that you have with the bees, right, is, well, they're technically not creepy, crawly things. They buzz and fly around. Mm-hmm. But let's say you live in a place where there are snakes. You would be fine to cover up the snake if you're worried about getting bitten. Now, some snakes bite, and, well, I guess all snakes have to bite. Just some are poisonous and some aren't. So you don't really need to worry about that, because Ramon says it's not even if they're dangerous. So you just don't want to get bitten. In theory, you know, whether or not you want to apply this to other stuff, like, say, can you trap a rabid dog, right? You know, that could be a health issue, too. I don't want to get into the details here, because I'm honest, you're going to find, I would assume, differences of opinion. I honestly have not looked into this in detail. To what extent are we strict regarding specifically Ramashim, the creepy crawling things? Right. Because if you're worried about a dog biting you, well, then that could be an issue, too. You don't want to have your dogs out and, or biting other people. You also don't want to get stung by bees. I will leave those as open questions and let people handle it as they may, only pointing out again that you can get bee traps for Sukkot and set those up before Shabbat. Or Yom Tov, I should say. They're like these little... Trust me, you can find them. And we used to do that, again, to avoid such problems. If you can do it beforehand, great. Otherwise, you know, if you do, you know, put a cup over a bee, do you have a reason to be lenient? In theory, sure. I'm guessing people are going to argue about that. Alrighty. So that's it for this week. We'll see you all Wednesday. And a reminder that this Thursday is Ta'anit Esther. And we got a fun Purim plan this week. So, this year just happens to be this week, too. Mm-hmm. So.